Welcome to ICTJ Forum, a conversation where we look at the latest news developments from a transitional justice perspective. Today, we will be talking about the implications of elections in Kenya. We will be discussing the prospects for transitional justice in the context of the crisis of the government in Tunisia, and also addressing the situation in Syria and any role that transitional justice could potentially play in the context. Today with us we have Paul Seals, the Vice President of ICTJ. Welcome, Paul.
Hello.
And Eduardo Gonzalez, Director of ICTJ's Truth and Memory Program. Welcome, Eduardo.
Thank you, Rafik.
Starting with Kenya, the leading ticket in the presidential elections in Kenya of Uhuru Kenyatta, the presidential candidate, and his running mate William Ruto is specific for the fact that they've been both indicted by the International Criminal Court. We will be exploring the implications of this. Paul, tell us, first of all, what does this mean for Kenya to have the prospect of the president and vice president being indicted by the International Criminal Court?
On the face of it, it's not an ideal campaigning situation, but it doesn't seem to be doing them too much harm, electorally speaking, at least as far as the polls were concerned before the election. I think the bigger issue is going to be if, as is anticipated by some pollsters, that if Kenyatta and Ruto win, then we have a very complicated situation. Will they continue to cooperate with the ICC? Will it provoke even greater instability, even having the president and the vice president in The Hague for a trial? Is hardly an auspicious beginning for a government should they win. So it's clearly a very unstable short term ahead, as I say, if they do win. And if they don't win this time around, then the prognosis, I think, is for the runoff election to take place in April, which is also very complicated. All things being equal, one would have much rather seen a quicker progress in the ICC case that would have seen at least the immediate difficulties resolved sometime before the election. On the other hand, one can say that they are deserving of the presumption of innocence and are entitled to run for anything until they're found guilty. I think that's a matter for the different ways different countries deal with standards in public life.
What do you think this will mean for the stability of the country if we consider that they've been indicted for incitement and involvement in the election violence in the last elections? Can we really hope that should they be eventually convicted, hypothetically, by the ICC, they will simply give up their positions and play along?
Well, I wouldn't anticipate anything from the ICC proceedings at all. I think they are, of course, fully entitled to a fair trial. We've already seen, you know, a relatively difficult track record for the ICC trials so far, and we've seen a very high standard demanded of the evidence in the recent acquittal of Ngojolo Chui in the Ituri case for the DRC. So I don't think it's sensible at all to presume that they will be convicted. They may or they may not be convicted, and I don't think we can have a very kind of meaningful guessing game about the way that would unfold. On the broader side of things, I mean, it is intriguing that two people who were opposing each other in the last elections and who were indicted in respect of having allegedly organised violence against each other's supporters are now standing on a unified ticket. I guess that some people might reflect on that and wonder if perversely the indictment has had a reconciling effect in Kenya, but I think that's a matter that will take longer time to unfold.
Eduardo, many say that one of the first victims of this newfound political accord between Kenyatta, Ruto and others involved allegedly in the violence 2007-2008 was the fate of Kenya's Truth, Justice and Reconciliation Commission, which was supposed to come out with its report, but had it delayed until after the elections. What will be the fate of that report? What will be its impact when it comes, if it ever sees the light of day?
Well, I actually think that the causality here is different. That is, I don't think that it is the political situation that has had an impact and has victimized, so to speak, the Truth Commission and has impeded the Truth Commission from its work. I think that, regrettably, the Commission did have a number of internal problems and problems in its relation with civil society that took it to the place it's at right now. The Truth Commission did have problems of governance because of disagreements between the commissioners with the chair of the commission and problems of legitimacy that caused the commission to be seen as not an appropriate partner by civil society for a long time. And as a result of that, the commission wasted a lot of time during its tenure. That is the efficient reason why the Truth Commission has not finished its final report. And as far as we know, is not really much closer to finishing this report. So in reality, this appears to have happened in a way that is sort of independent from the political scenario. Now, the situation, of course, is regrettable because you could think that a commission that was established precisely to look at an incident of electoral violence would have made an important contribution to Kenya before these elections to try to explain to Kenyan civil society and to Kenyan policymakers what is the cost of violence in politics and how to avoid this from happening again. The fact is that we are seeing again an election that has high levels of violence, and we can only ask ourselves now whether good process of truth and reconciliation through the commission would have made a contribution. Right now, that question has become regrettably academic.
Do you see the report, once it comes out, having any long-term effect, even in terms of establishing facts about what took place and then leading to maybe some other mechanisms which will deal with its recommendations?
The spirit behind the creation of the TJRC was a spirit of prevention. Policy makers in Kenya, the international community, civil society, wanted to avoid a repetition of what happened in the previous elections. So that rationale, regrettably, I think, is mostly lost. Now, it is unclear whether the Commission is in a position to actually gather its work and produce a report. If it does, it will come later in the year, well after the results of this election. Who knows if after the installation of an actual new government. We can only imagine how difficult is going to be the political environment for a commission to publish a report after an election where one of the main contenders is, in fact, Mr. Kenyatta. So I think that the panorama, the scenario, doesn't look pretty promising for the commission in this particular case. It looks like an opportunity that has been missed, and that is very regrettable.
We'll be monitoring the situation in Kenya very closely over the next few days. But Paul, you wanted to add.
Yeah, I think, as Eduardo says, the panorama for transitional justice thus far in Kenya is pretty uniformly bleak. And the two things that I think are standing out as potential new issues on the horizon that perhaps haven't had the attention that they need is the process of judicial vetting that has taken place. If I recall the numbers rightly, 69 High Court, Appeal Court judges have been vetted under this system, with the removal of 14 of them. That's a significant process. It looks like a fairly serious and robust process, both in terms of the investigations and the due process issues. They're now moving on to deal with 351 or 352 at the magistrate level. There's mixed reports about how effective the lower level vetting has been, but on the face of it, those are things that shouldn't be ignored. The allegations of the corruption of the judiciary in Kenya have been very, very profound, and this is a significant move. The other issue, of course, is the moves to create the International Criminal Division in the criminal jurisdiction. Again, this seems like yet another attempt to prosecute, allegedly, the post-election violence from the last election. Whether or not that's a very well thought through or effective proposal, we'll have to wait and see. But it looks like at least those two things are things that we certainly will be looking at very, very closely.
I think that this gives us a good window into the next issue, because it has to do with demands for reform of institutions, of course, in a completely different part of the world, in Tunisia, where we have seen what was hailed as the most promising process of transitional justice of all of the so-called Arab Spring countries. However, after the February 6 murder of the leading opposition politician Chakri Belaid, the government went into a nosedive, it was dissolved, and we are now in a political vacuum, which, of course, nobody can at this point predict how it will play out. ICTJ has been involved in the process. We have a memorandum of understanding with the previous government. We have taken part in the National Dialogue on Transitional Justice and have provided extensive technical assistance. How do you see all the current political turbulence affecting the process, affecting the transitional justice framework, especially when it comes to the adoption and implementation of different laws?
The first thing that has been relatively surprising is the exposure of the fragility of the situation in Tunisia. I think most people had hoped that the foundations were stronger than they appear to be. On the other hand, it would be premature to say that the whole thing has collapsed. It would be very, very far from that at this point. We still look as if we're looking at elections that one would have no reason to think will be other than peaceful elections at this stage. Tunisia is not a country with a history of political assassinations, much less mass violence and killings. And I would certainly hope that the single assassination that has led to the current instability will prove to be that kind of aberration. On the other hand, I think it raises a number of issues, both about the way in which we assess the conditions in which we try to implement transitional justice policies. I think there's always a very understandable situation where we want to hope for the best and capitalise on even the smallest opportunities. These are the most delicate balances of political outcomes that you're looking at, and this is one of these situations where we've got an unexpected outcome that's taken us down a road that we had no real inkling of. I think it really just shows that trying to work in the initial aftermath of regime change or revolution or post-conflict, whichever the setting is you're dealing at the absolute crucible of politics and everything else in terms of social fabric. And these things are very hard to forecast.
Eduardo, you yourself traveled to Tunisia on several occasions in recent months. It seems that regardless of the different divisions between secularists and Islamists, there is a consensus on the need for the reckoning with the past, for addressing the past abuses. Of course, differences arise from different views on how quickly this process should unfold, what should be the priorities. But do you think that the process itself could become a victim to the political turbulence that we are seeing?
During the time I have participated in meetings in Tunisia, what I realize is that in reality the positions that the different groups express regarding the Truth Commission are closer than they themselves think them to be. In reality, you see a level of polarization in the debate about transitional justice and about the Truth Commission that is probably contaminated, so to speak, by the polarization that pervades the political sphere. When you examine, however, the concrete proposals that are put on the table and that were put on the table in the process of building the bill that is going to the National Constituent Assembly, the proposals are not that far away. And in reality, then, I think that this is clearly a case where the instability of the transition itself, the difficulties of self-government after so many years of a dictatorship, imperil policymaking on a number of areas. Of course, we are talking from the standpoint of observers and specialists on transitional justice, but I think that you can say very similar things about other areas of policymaking in Tunisia that are suffering because of the general polarization in the country.
Do you think that the polarization that you have described could also result in problems and obstacles, let's put aside the current political issues that exist, in the implementation of these measures? Concretely, recently I spoke to Kelly Madel, about the work of our gender justice unit there. And she was saying how different victim groups, women groups, are seeing the implementation of these initiatives from a different perspective that is determined by their experience of the dictatorship. The Islamist groups are saying, where were you with your human rights agenda when we suffered, while the secularist groups are basically very wary of the Islamist agenda at the moment. Do you think this dynamic could actually affect the implementation of, for instance, the Truth Commission in Tunisia?
Well, I think every Truth Commission works in a terrain where these kind of ideological contradictions, ideological tensions, and mutual recriminations already exist. Truth commissions do not work necessarily in a peaceful situation where all these processes have been overcome. On the contrary, truth commissions do work precisely in this kind of situation, the situation you have described, where there are very widely divergent interpretations of what happened and why, and where there is blaming and mutual misunderstanding. So I don't expect that that situation is going to change too much when the Truth Commission is established. I remain confident that it will be established. But I think that it's actually incumbent on the Commission to find creative ways to actually propitiate a dialogue and a debate that is constructive. A Truth Commission, in my view, does clarify the historical record and does establish the facts about human rights violations so that it provides an objective platform of information upon which an actual informed debate can happen. By doing that, a truth commission can facilitate the discussion between different tendencies, between different groups or forms of looking at the country, because it provides them with a space for discussion and it provides them with an objective scientific reconstruction of events. So hopefully, when the Truth Commission is established, it may become a factor not of further division and polarization, but on the contrary, a factor of establishing dialogue and catalyzing more constructive outcomes in the process.
I think it is very interesting that we are discussing such a scenario in Tunisia, while in other countries of the Middle East and North Africa, where similar hopes existed for transitional justice processes, we are seeing deterioration in Egypt. The reports from Port Said are talking about some 10 people killed today in clashes. Libya is still very unstable. However, I don't think there is a more pressing, more tragic scenario at the moment than Syria. In Syria, according to UNHCR, we already have more than 963,000 refugees. We have over 60,000 people killed. And on the 18th of February, the UN Commission of Inquiry filed a report headed by Paulo Sergio Pinheiro, which basically said that there were widespread crimes against humanity and war crimes being committed in Syria, and recommended that it is referred to the ICC. At the same time, we have heard from different groups and initiatives, foreign governments, talk of transitional justice tools, so to say, being considered as a peacemaking tool, as means of ending this conflict. Is there any point in discussing transitional justice in the context that it is understood as a set of measures working to instill a civic trust in the aftermath of atrocities or dictatorship in a context where conflict is still going on to the degree that it is in Syria?
One of the ongoing debates that we've had in ICTJ since the beginning of its existence has been, what are the circumstances where transitional justice can actually play a meaningful role? And I think the answer to that is always contingent on the context itself. And people will give you different descriptions of what those conditions have to be. They may have to do with the distribution of power between the parties vis-a-vis the pre-existing regime and what the regime is afterwards. It may have to do with the power and mobilization of civil society, the level of articulacy and education of victims groups. All of these kinds of things are significant factors in the kinds of ways in which transitional justice policies can actually play a significant role. And I think there is a distinction to be made between transitional justice, if you like, in a relatively purer kind of conception, which to me would be more about how do we make real the issues of the rights of victims in the face of massive human rights violations, and how do we make real the hope that institutions are more solid guarantors of those fundamental rights. And that set against a harder question about what role those ideas can play in the pursuit of a peace process. The pursuit of the peace process at the moment seems to me to be a rather different issue in Syria. I think the biggest issue in Syria at the moment is that no one has any idea what's going to happen. No one has any idea what the balance of power is going to be if and when the Assad regime falls. No one has any idea what the level of former government penetration will remain of institutions. No one has any idea what the strength of the infrastructure is going to be other than extraordinarily weak. No one has any idea of what the demands are going to be on the structures in order to just survive the weeks and months immediately after. So it seems to me an incredibly premature situation to talk meaningfully about specific transitional justice measures, and probably even very general transitional justice measures, other than saying that accountability is important and has to take place. It seems to me just simply too early to be trying to make very detailed analysis of what should happen.
Eduardo?
I agree with Paul's observation that this is a very premature moment to discuss the possibilities of transitional justice in Syria. Now, having said that, there are a couple of other issues in there. One is whether you can expect that transitional justice can be an instrument for peacemaking. I am somehow skeptical about it. I think that transitional justice can consolidate an ongoing peace process that exists actually in the terrain, and that transitional justice, if implemented adequately, can enhance the quality of the peace that you can obtain in a given country after the parties have negotiated. But I don't think that transitional justice instruments in themselves are going to provide, per se, the incentives for the parties to actually stop the conflict. Now, I anticipate that, of course, in their interest to try to find solutions to the conflict. Mediators or the international community may mention the examples of other countries where a peace is facilitated or enhanced in its quality by transitional justice situations. In that context, I don't doubt that people are going to start talking about whether justice measures will be conducive to peace or not, whether truth-seeking could make a contribution to peace or not, etc. That is still an open question, and we have to see how the realities in the terrain actually evolve. Now, another subject, though, at a very practical level, is that, of course, what is happening right now needs to be very carefully noted and documented. We are talking about hundreds of thousands of people who have been displaced, who are crossing the borders or are displaced inside the country to save their lives. And these persons are witnesses to horrendous atrocities. Their experiences will have to be recognized at some process later on when this conflict is over. And I think their experiences, what they have lived, should be respected in that sense when it is possible to talk about the necessary process of reconstruction for this country.
Is there a danger in sort of cut and paste approach that may become sort of seductive to the peacemakers as they go about looking for a solution? We have seen mentions of very specific measures called transitional justice tools being considered and actually tabled by certain parties to the negotiations around what will happen in Syria, quoting scenarios from South Africa, Northern Ireland, and saying, let's offer those around Bashar al-Assad amnesty, except to those in his inner circle, to try and avoid a fight to the death in Damascus. Is amnesty a transitional justice tool?
No. Not for me, at least. We kind of go through this a lot, but the comparison, and of course the ones that are very well known, are South Africa is often mentioned, you've just mentioned Northern Ireland, It's probably not a coincidence that these are English-speaking and not necessarily particularly reflective of transitional justice experiences. And just as a matter of fact, we should remember that there was no amnesty in Northern Ireland, that the vast majority of paramilitaries from nationalist and unionist sides had swathes of people investigated and prosecuted and spending long times in jail. So amnesty doesn't have anything to do with the Northern Ireland situation. If people are talking seriously about amnesty in the situation of Assad and his regime and perhaps the rebels as well, I think the simple reality is that the goalposts have moved very, very significantly in the last 10, 15, arguably 20 years. That the idea of amnesty for very serious crimes is just off the table, and that the most that I can see being circulated, as we saw, for example, in the rather confused example of Gaddafi, you had the slightly unpalatable situation of the Security Council voting unanimously to refer the Libyan situation to the prosecutor of the ICC. You have within 3 days, in fact, slightly quicker, the prosecutor of the ICC announcing the opening of that investigation. And within 5 days after that, you've got the British Home Secretary saying that they would be open to the idea of a safe passage for Gaddafi to a non-jurisdiction state outside the reach of the ICC. So the complete incapacity of policymakers to see through the implications of what they're talking about is a major challenge in these areas. I don't know that that's going to come up as a real issue in the ICC, because I don't really think it's likely that Russia and China will ever allow this matter to be referred to the ICC. That might change, but by this stage in the game, there seems to be no reason for that to be expected. I don't think offering amnesty is a serious way of getting over the issue of the senior authority representatives on either side if they've committed serious crimes. The issues might well be how do you deal with rank and file issues later on, but at this stage in the game, I don't think anyone in the international community or anyone from the peacemaking community can seriously suggest that amnesty is a prospect for these very serious crimes.
I think that in the same way in which amnesty is not a measure of revenge, it's not a measure of justice either. I think that amnesties and acts of revenge are things that happen in several conflicts, in several situations in which there is a revolution or a war, but they do not constitute measures of justice. In reality, both are measures that deny the essential principles of justice. Justice is, above all, a procedure of fairness that contributes to clarify facts and to clarify responsibilities so that a society can move in a peaceful way ahead, putting behind these events. What happens when you have an amnesty is that events that are unacceptable are retroactively pardoned, retroactively authorized. They happened, they were unacceptable, but they carry no consequences for the doers. On the other side, for me, that act seems as arbitrary as the act of revenge and arbitrary executions of a tyrant. You have had situations in which, for example, in Libya, victorious rebel group takes hold of a dictator and simply executes this person. For me, that is also a denial of justice in the sense that you just have an immediate act of revenge that denies the victims any kind of meaningful clarification of the situation and denies to a country the moral authority of trying to build a society that is radically different from the kind of tyranny it has experienced. So in the case of Syria, for me, and cases similar to Syria, I do not think that looking into any of those two extremes, the extreme of absolute vengeance or on the other side, gratuitous forgiveness, can be seen as elements of transitional justice. I see those possibilities as acts of politics, acts of power. There may be attempts to legitimize those acts of power with some kind of varnish of legality. It is possible that you may see a decree authorizing an arbitrary execution in the same way that it is possible to see a decree or a law passing an amnesty. But we have to be clear that in reality, denials of justice cannot be considered as instruments of justice. They are behind that. They are actions of power, to be clear. So the question remains, if you want to have a process that is effective in the sense of stopping the bloodshed, But on the other side, you also have a process that gives Syria a better chance to build itself as a state ruled by law after the conflict. You need to go beyond facile solutions, such as a blanket amnesty or just a blanket revenge. I don't think that those two avenues can contribute to a really peaceful society after the conflict.
I mean, it's both an interesting philosophical discussion, but a very practical one. It's the question to which, to what degree is transitional justice conceived of as a transaction? To what degree is it an issue of, I'll give you benefits X, Y, and Z if you give me information A, B, and C? And to some extent, I actually think that however valid and important the South African experience was, we sometimes labour under a misapprehension that that's what transitional justice is about. And as Eduardo says, I think where the proposition is in fact a denial of justice, it really isn't a serious conversation to suggest that that's part of a transitional justice package. I think there are gradations and very complex circumstances where it becomes harder and harder to distinguish between a transaction that can further the prospects of peace on the one hand and a transaction that is really about the quality of justice on the other. These are very hard things to disaggregate, but I think by and large, at a minimum, you can say measures that deny justice can be part of the package.
Well, gentlemen, on 21st of March, we will celebrate the 10th anniversary of the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission and have an opportunity to analyze its legacy, which is very real to this date. Thank you very much for taking part in ICTJ Forum. Hopefully, by the time we are with you again, dear listeners, we will have better news from Kenya, Tunisia, and Syria. Until then, warm greetings from ICTJ's headquarters in New York.